The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from Wright Memorial Public Library, Clark County Public Library, Tipp City Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Washington Centerville Public Library.
Good morning, welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. Almost 30 years ago, I did my first interview with a writer named Joseph Cannon. He had a long career in publishing. He was the president and editor-in-chief of Houghton Mifflin, also the publisher Dutton. And then he decided to become a novelist, a best-selling novelist. He published another novel last year. It was his 11th. It was called Shanghai. He writes a lot about espionage. Back in 1997, we talked about his debut novel, Los Alamos. And it was quite a novel, and he's gone on to quite a career. We had him on the show a number of times back in the day because back then, a lot of writers would come through Dayton and stop at Books & Company and Kettering on book tours. And that's exactly what he did with his debut novel, Los Alamos. Let's listen now to Joseph Cannon as we revisit an interview that goes back almost three decades on the Best of the Book Nook.
Good afternoon, Miami Valley. Welcome to the Afternoon Excursions Book Nook. It's my pleasure to welcome to the program Joseph Cannon. He has just written his first novel. It's called Los Alamos. Good afternoon.
Hi, how are you, Vic?
Very good. This is quite an amazing thing. You have your first book out, and you're receiving all kinds of very complimentary reviews. What's the deal?
Well, I would hope that they really mean it, so I guess that's the deal. I will tell you an interesting... You know, I was a publisher for years, and one of the differences in being on one side of the desk or the other is that a publisher looks at a review with tunnel vision just for that one quotable line that he can use in an ad. What I discovered is that the writer looks for the one bad negative word in any given paragraph, and you don't see anything else. But so far, the reviews have been very generous, so I'm glad.
Los Alamos, I'm sure most of our listeners are familiar at least with the name Los Alamos. Give us some background on this particular location.
Sure. This is a book that actually began with the place. I was there two summers ago. I loved the Southwest, and I was out there as a tourist and visited because I'd always been interested in the Manhattan Project and was absolutely fascinated to walk around thinking this really is one of the great stories of all time. It is not, I think, as well known as it ought to be, and it was the moment that the proverbial light bulb goes off over your head and said, gee, it would make a great setting for a novel. What particularly intrigued me was the secrecy of the place. It is now a city of about 11,000 people. You can visit it. People do. There's an historical museum. Most of the people there still work in scientific research, most of which, I guess, is funded by the government. The laboratories are still restricted, and one doesn't know exactly what is going on up there. However, in the spring of 1945, it was the most secret place in the world. And this is what really fascinated me. I thought, here is a place that does not officially exist. If you were a member of the Manhattan Project assigned there, you signed on for the duration. There were letters went to a drop somewhere. No telephones, no fraternization with the locals, no travel. It was, you had literally dropped off the end of the world as far as anybody back home was concerned. And I thought, what would happen in a place that doesn't officially exist if there were a crime? What kind of effect would this produce? How would they go about solving it? There were no police on the Mesa. No one was allowed. The Santa Fe police were not meant to know it even existed. So how do you work that? That was the germ of the idea. The place itself that you might see now is not at all the Los Alamos of 1945. It was a real jerry-built, rough-and-ready kind of boom construction town then, largely because it had the Manhattan Project mushroomed overnight. In 1943, when Oppenheimer and General Groves selected it as a site, they did so because it was remote. It's 40 miles from Santa Fe, and that was a lot further in those days than it is now. There were no highways. There was a dirt road up the mesa that was really like a mule track. And what existed there was a boys' school. It was a sort of dude ranch finishing school for Eastern kids who needed to be toughened up and do some ranch work along with reading, writing, arithmetic. Gore Vidal was an alumnus.
Oh, really?
I still don't know how he feels about his time at Los Alamos, but it must have done him some good, I suppose. But what was there, consequently, was the infrastructure of the school buildings. They imagined in 1943 that there would be 300 people on the project. By the spring of 45, which is when the novel is set, there were 5,000 up there. So they never stopped building it. It was like walking into almost a Klondike rush, gold rush kind of environment where things were going up all the time, people complaining about lack of housing, water problems, any of the things that happen in the West under a great boom stress. At the same time, what was going on there was so exhilarating to the scientists because they were, aside from anything else, when I got into this and started looking into it more deeply and became even more fascinated because it was so contradictory, it was a young man's town. I was surprised to discover the average age of people at Los Alamos was 27. Oppenheimer himself was only in his mid-30s all during this period. So what you get are kids, young men, who are not just the best in the field and smarter than anybody has a right to be, but they are now going to be in what I call at some point an enchanted campus. There are some, if you look from the outside of the fence, it maybe is a glorified concentration camp because you're impounded there. It was not quite that strict, but there was very, very strict security. Nevertheless, for the people there, when you read their memoirs or their letters or accounts of that time, what comes across is the sheer exhilaration of being there with other people who were really tops in the field, that they were going to conquer some new frontier, I guess, to do a cliche, in science, literally convert matter to energy. It must have been fantastically exciting to them just on an intellectual level. Layered on to that, even more important, and I think this is harder for us to understand now because it's 50 years later, they were going to win the war. I mean, these were the kids with thick glasses and slide rules and not the ones who marched off to do battle in that way, who were told, you have an opportunity not just to do this amazing thing in science, you can end the war, you can win it for us. So there was a tremendous motivation for them to do it, and it spilled over, I think, into the work hours. It was famously lit up at night with people never stopping. It was also not sure, or it was not certain, that it could happen. I mean, until the Trinity test in July of 45, it was numbers on papers. No one really knew if it would work. You can suppose and you can surmise and you can put all your best theories together, but until it goes off, it hasn't really happened. I guess it's like the log falling in the forest, that if there's nobody there to hear it, does it really fall? Consequently, there was a tremendous urgency about getting it done and getting it done in time. Allied with that, and what really intrigued me, I think, more than anything about the story, was the role of the European emigres. It wasn't just kids from Caltech and very bright Americans from Chicago and elsewhere, although certainly they were the majority of the people there. But there was a very large international contingent of people, almost all of whom were refugees from the Nazis, most of them Jewish, and who had come literally sometimes escaping with their lives from Europe and were now being given a chance to work on a project that would not simply end the war, but it had the dual motivation that no one knew how far the Germans were in their program. And these were people who knew some of the principles in the German program. They had worked with Heisenberg. They knew the caliber of the scientists involved, and they knew it was possible, if the resources were thrown at it, that the Germans might be not only as far as we were, but possibly even further. This was a literally intolerable thought it was just unthinkable that the Nazis could develop an atomic bomb. Even now, 50 years later, I think it's unthinkable. What happens in the spring, however, intrigued me as a great moral dilemma. Supposing for all the right reasons you have participated in a program which is not just intellectually exciting, but is on some level heroic. It was a heroic thing to do, and it was deemed by them to be not just worthwhile, but really necessary to do. What happens when Germany drops out of the war? What do you do with the bomb then? All of a sudden, reservations and questions come up. I think I said when I went to Los Alamos, it was the summer of 95. And one of the other things that got me going on the book or suggested the story to me was it was also the summer of 50th anniversary of Hiroshima. And there was a great deal of coverage in the press or a great deal of talk in the media about the dropping of the bomb. And what fascinated me was that it was all done from the point of view of 1995. It now is described almost strictly as a moral decision and having to do with environmental factors that weren't even really considered then. There were people who in my childhood had been considered heroes, rightly or wrongly, but they were considered heroes. And all of a sudden, they'd become demonized. It was as if our new notion was that there were 50 Dr. Strangelove sitting in the desert trying to figure out a way to bring the end of the world about. I thought, I don't think so. I don't think that's what it was like. And the more I got interested in it, the more I thought, what was it like? What did they think about? How did they spend the days? What actually happened there? And of course, you get into an obsessive quasi-novelist interest in this. You play games with yourself. You even like to figure out, well, how did they do their laundry? You know, just the day-to-day things that you may not even use in the book, but just knowing what the life was like. That, to me, was the really interesting part. I think that the importance, I mean, if there can ever be called a seminal event in our time or a turning point, it had to have been, I think, the Trinity explosion. Everything since is a different world from what came before. And given the importance of that, it seemed to me that even an entertainment, which is what I wanted the book to be, would have an underlying resonance that it would be, I wanted this to be a mystery and a love story, but I wanted it to be about something. And the thing I wanted it to be about was what it was like then. What were the circumstances that caused people to make the decisions they did? Not that the scientists were ultimately responsible for that decision, but how did they feel about it? How did they feel about it then, later, etc., etc.? Thus the book.
I was amazed when I heard that President Truman didn't even know about Los Alamos, yet over in Russia, they had spies who knew there was something going on, and your research has shown that they knew a lot more than we thought they knew.
Yes, very much so. Well, there are two parts to this. Let's talk about Truman first, because it's the more amusing side, I think, now in retrospect of the story. The Manhattan Project, although we now know it to have been undermined by Soviet intelligence, was in fact at the time the most secret project probably of all time. The scale of it makes it even more impressive. At Los Alamos, there were, as I said, about 5,000 people just under, but there were also massive installations at Oak Ridge where they were separating fuel and at Hanford, Washington, so that the total number of people involved may have been almost as many as 20,000 people. The cost of this program was $5 billion in 1940 dollars, which would translate, depending on who you believe in terms of time translation, to about $80 billion now, all of it hidden. The only people in Congress who were aware of this at all were, I think there were one or two members who were liaisons or clued into the scientific committee that actually directed this project and reported directly to Roosevelt. No one else knew. You know, for those of us who live in a tabloid age and where leaks and where nothing seems to be secret, it's astonishing how well kept the secret really was. Certainly Congress did not know about it, and famously Truman did not know. It is said that after Roosevelt died, it was, I think, the second or third day into the presidency, that Stinson, who was then Secretary of War, came to the office and said the equivalent of, "Mr. President, I think there's something you should know." What we don't know is, and what I would dearly love to know, is Truman's thoughts when he heard this. And I can imagine that his feelings about Roosevelt took about a 180-degree move, if they hadn't already been there. Nevertheless, it was his decision to make, and he was stuck with the results of a project that had already come almost to fruition. Now, so far as the Soviet effort is concerned, one of the other things that happened in the summer of 95 when I was thinking about this is that the National Security Agency finally released, why it's taken so long, I don't know, what has come to be called the Venona decrypts. These were Soviet communiques which we had intercepted and decoded, mostly dating from the war, and had secretly decoded. And what they reveal is that the effort to penetrate the Manhattan Project, which understandably would have been any nation's major intelligence effort if there is this kind of secret project going on, was far more extensive than what we had been led to believe, or certainly what I had believed up to that time. There was famously, of course, Klaus Fuchs and David Greenglass, and then leading to the Rosenbergs, and I never wanted to do a Romana Clay about Klaus Fuchs. I thought this story is very well known and eventually gets into waters that were not really my concern because of what happened to all of the people many years later. But what the Venona decrypt suggested is that there were other agents in the field. There were other people trying to penetrate this project, some of whom we still don't know about. There simply wasn't information that would come out of these communiques to identify them. The New York Times, when they were covering the declassification of the documents, suggested that there were possibly as many as 200 Soviet agents attached to this project. Now, so far as I know, maybe they were mostly couriers in Washington. But it did occur to me, what if some of them were in Los Alamos? What I wanted to do was a story that would be historically plausible and could actually have happened in parallel time to the story we know to have happened, and one would not contradict the other. So we can, as you read it, or I hope this would be the effect, even though we know about Klaus Fuchs, or if you don't know about him, I suppose the story is even better because then you are unaware of this, you can still find this story plausible, that it doesn't intersect with what actually happened, but is meant to be possibly what happened. And for all we know, since we don't know all of the agents who were involved, maybe it did on some level.
In 1945, when we let that nuclear genie out of the bottle, that we lost our innocence as human beings, that it was a whole new world.
Oh, I think without question. Even more, I don't say more interestingly, but equally interesting, it seems to me that, you know, it's that be very careful what you do because you don't really know what the consequences will be. This never, of course, has prevented anybody from doing it, nor on some level should it. But one of the ironic effects of this group of brilliant scientists who had come for, I believe, the right reasons and who were trying to do the right thing and who were conquering science, who were doing something really triumphant, one of the awful ironies is that they actually produced something that caused people to question science itself or the perfectibility of this kind of thing for the first time in hundreds of years. It was not immediate, of course, but as time wore on and the real effects of what we had unleashed became apparent to everyone, people began questioning the act of this kind of intellectual inquiry itself. This would have been, I think, the last thing that any scientist would have wanted to have happened. You know, such things go on even now. I mean, is there any among us who really doesn't expect that at some point we're going to open the newspaper and there is going to be an extraordinary moral dilemma created by what we're doing in biotech? I don't know what it will be. All I know is that something probably is going to come along because this too is that uncharted territory where we don't quite know where the boundaries are. It will be an extraordinary moral dilemma. On the other hand, that's not necessarily an argument about not pursuing it. I think also that we have to keep in mind that people literally did not know in 1945 as much as certainly we came to know about the effects of this. To me, there are certain dramatic moments. It is said that when the test at Trinity actually occurred, when Oppenheimer and some of the other scientists saw it physically, the thing they'd been working on night and day, and I suppose at some level must have imagined, but at that precise moment, many of them went through a traumatic experience. It was more than numbers on papers. It was something really earth-shaking. And I think the very best of them, although I'm not casting aspersions on anybody, but I think the more sensitive of them really took two steps back at that point and said, what are we doing? What is this all about? And the people who were truly alert to the problems that would ensue were very eager to participate in the public debate about who would control this genie. I mean, was this strictly speaking a military tool? Was this something that civilians should control? How are we going to use it? It's difficult for us now because we come out of an era where we think of this in terms of meltdown. But at the time, it was also an extraordinarily promising thing. I mean, those of the listeners who are as old as I am, that is 50, can remember a time when nuclear energy was going to be the most wonderful thing that ever happened to anybody. It was going to save the world and nobody would have to lift a finger and everything would be terrific. At the same time, we were also being led through air raid drills and ducking under our desks and being told that if you were within this perimeter of a circle on the blackboard, you probably would be vaporized. Or as they were telling you this, they would say, duck under the desk in case of, you know, glass. And you think, somehow this is not adding up. You know, either you get vaporized or you're worrying about the windows going. It was a great schizophrenia about how we were going to relate to this. And of course, once it became the bombs of later years, the bombs of Los Alamos are certainly symbolic. I mean, aside from the horrifying destruction that they caused, but they are not even remotely as threatening or horrifying as what came later. And many of the scientists in the book, or characters who would be scientists in the book, are not necessarily those people. I mean, the Strangelove era that came in with the superbomb and Edward Teller's hydrogen bomb and mutually assured destruction and that whole madness of the 50s, these were a few years down the pike. These bombs were horrifying, but they weren't, and I think it's an important point to make, they were not necessarily more horrifying than other things we were doing in the war at that time. You know, the firebombing of Tokyo, supposedly, I mean, statistics that I've read suggest that there may have been as many as 250,000 people wiped out. That's an astonishing number. I mean, the number of casualties at Hiroshima is estimated at 60, 65,000. Now, one is too many. I'm not trying to suggest that there's a degree of terror or that we have some, you know, I would not suggest there's a hierarchy of suffering. I think, you know, suffering and death are what they are. Nevertheless, it's a lot more explicable to us or understandable to think what would go through their heads at the time, and particularly the military. They had already been brutalized. This was a war in which, I rejoice to say, there has been nothing like it since, and I hope there never will be again. But we now look at photographs and distance has made it slightly romantic or quaint. It wasn't anything of the sort. It was the most horrifying event in human history. And by the time people came to the end of it, everyone was brutalized by it. To get statistics of Okinawa, for instance, which was happening during May of 45, when these people were finishing completion of this, the casualties there are estimated at 100,000, including civilians. You know, 55,000 Americans died in Vietnam, by contrast, in the whole war. So 100,000 casualties for a single island is, you know, beyond comment. I mean, and seemed so at the time. And I think that anyone in the military, anyone in a policy-making decision who was aware of this and aware of just how horrifyingly brutal it had become wanted to do anything to end it. I know that there's a great deal of talk and theory about the fact that the decision to drop the bomb, which is not what this book is about, by the way, but the decision to drop it was essentially racist in motive. I don't know that that's true. I think unquestionably there was a lot of racism about the Japanese during the war. But when I read the original literature, what fascinated me was that nobody was talking about Japan. They were talking about Germany. And many of the people who were involved in this project, you know, the question is, would we have dropped it on the Germans? Oh, I think so. I'm not saying we should have, but I think it would have happened in that context. I don't think it was, strictly speaking, a racial issue. Nevertheless, this gets us into the present and the stuff that we bring to this story. And what I wanted to do was to go back to that point when it was really the high water mark, when a lot of these reservations had not set in, when people didn't know the permanent environmental damage or the real effects of fallout. I mean, we are all of us familiar with those photographs of army tests in the early 50s where people sit there in sunglasses with their hair blowing behind them, and you think, well, where are they now? You know, there was a lot of innocence.
I think they're dead, Joe.
I think they're dead too, yes. But at the time, it was very exciting for them. They were not, I think, evil Dr. Strangeloves who were trying to... They were scientists trying to do something that had never been done before and being told by everyone that it was the most worthwhile thing in the world to do because you could end the war.
And that's a wrap on the Best of the Book Nook for your Sunday. Joseph Cannon on 91.3 WYSO, community-owned public radio. For curious listeners. And the last thing he said on that segment was, because you could end the war. And that really resonated with me, because I think that's what most of us want on this planet right now, is to end the war. We can't call it World War III quite yet, but if it doesn't end soon, who knows? They ended that war, World War II, with a couple of horrific atomic blasts in Japan. They finally surrendered. Joseph Cannon talking about it, and the researchers at Los Alamos going back to 1997 for that interview. He's a best-selling author. He's now published 11 books. His final one was Shanghai, which came out last year. That's book number 11. I'm sure he's working on more. He's been very successful, and he had a long career in publishing. He was the president of Houghton Mifflin and editor-in-chief. He was also over at the imprint Dutton, and a lot has changed in publishing since he retired from the field. A lot of these publishing houses have consolidated or disappeared. I don't think Houghton Mifflin exists anymore, and Dutton is now a part of Penguin, which then became part of Random House. So it's Penguin Random House, and it's all very confusing. But I'm here to keep it all clear and straight for you on the Best of the Book Nook. Thanks for listening. I hope you have a really great rest of your Sunday. Happy Easter to those who observe.